This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Hold your devices a little closer today, because the way we interact with the internet and social media might drastically change in the future. Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the Boston Globe, joins us now for this week's edition of TED Talk. Welcome back, Hiawatha.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. And no, it's not a TED Talk. It's a Tech Talk.
Did I say TED Talk? I think I said TED Talk. But I probably said TED Talk. I'm watching one for later tonight. All right. So this is about the Supreme Court hearing two cases, right? This is about social media use of algorithms is the key piece. So I want to start there and explain again for people what is an algorithm and how is it used in social media.
Well, it's just a fancy word for a plan of doing things where you have a step-by-step sequence of programmed steps that you follow to achieve a particular result. People just call them algorithms. It's a fancier word. But in this case, we are talking about software that monitors the way a person uses social media, figures out what they like or don't like, and they have an algorithm that automatically starts flagging stuff that you have shown some interest in, or that people who have looked at the kinds of things you look at have in the past shown that they are also interested in. I mean, it happens everywhere. When you do a Google search, Google actually... What I get on a Google search may be different from what you get on a Google search, because when I use Google, I look for different things than you do. And it has tracked what I do, and its algorithms have figured out, this is Hiawatha. This is what I'm going to give him. And that's going to be entirely different from what I give other people. Well, that's what happens when you use social media. My Facebook feed is showing me very different stuff from what yours might show you. Twitter does that. When you go to YouTube to look at videos, same thing here.
All right, and that's at the heart of this. So the key Supreme, there are two cases, but the main case, it's against Google. The family of a victim who died in a 2015 ISIS attack in Paris is accusing Google of essentially supporting terrorism by using these algorithms to push terrorist content. So explain that.
Right. Well, the idea is that if you kept looking at videos relating to ISIS on YouTube, the algorithm would notice that you were doing that, and they'd keep sending you more and more and more. In addition, YouTube makes money by running advertising connected to the videos that they show. And there were multiple press reports about how they were actually including ads with ISIS recruitment videos that were popping up on YouTube. And they have vowed to try to stop that. And I'm sure they have made some effort to weed out these videos, but they were actually during this period routinely popping up on videos relating to ISIS.
And Google owns YouTube.
That's right. Google owns YouTube. And of course, Alphabet is the parent company of all of them. It's called Alphabet. I just want to clear that up. Okay. Meanwhile, they're saying here that by associating advertising with these videos, Google is making money off of them. And because when they do that, they share revenues with the people publishing the videos, they are indirectly supporting terrorism.
Also funding it, essentially.
Yes, funding it, essentially. But the core issue is that they are saying that by using algorithms to promote certain content, Google is actively pushing it on viewers. And that means that they should not be entitled to protection under a famous federal law called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. This has been called the Magna Carta of the Internet. The whole reason that these social networks can do what they do is because of this law, which was passed in 1996.
And as I understand it, this Section 30...
230.
Section 230. So I looked this up. It's a section of Title 47 of the codes that resulted from the Communications Decency Act of 1996.
Right.
And it basically says immunity for website platforms regarding third-party content on those platforms.
Exactly. In other words, if you post something outrageous, hateful, evil, dangerous on Facebook or Twitter or a YouTube video, you're responsible. They're not. Because they are simply publishing it as an open forum, and they're not responsible for what people, not legally responsible for what people post there.
So what's different here, Hiawatha, and this is fascinating to me, if I understand it, is the difference here is it's the push.
Exactly. You got to remember, 1996. This is a key thing to remember. Back in 1996, when you posted something on the internet, it was just like sitting there on a forum, and you would have to go and find it yourself. It wasn't until like around the mid-2000s that these companies came up with this idea of using artificial intelligence to figure out what you might be interested in and then shove you copies of other stuff that was similar to it. And these people are arguing that that changes everything. Suddenly, companies like Facebook, YouTube, Twitter are now responsible for what they're feeding people because they have got this program that decides, I'm going to send you more of this these videos. I'm going to send you more videos about railroad trains. I'm going to send you more videos about Star Wars. I'm going to send you more videos about threatening to go on a jihad and kill infidels. I'm going to do all that. And they're saying you're responsible for that now, YouTube. And if the Supreme Court buys that argument, it's going to completely transform the way social media can work.
Okay, so we're gonna hold that there for a second because right. There's the second case. And I do want to note, as I understand it, Associate Justice Clarence Thomas has indicated in some other opinions, with the right case, it's probably time to look at
right.
Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act.
Oh, good heavens. This is just the beginning. Okay. I'm going to interrupt you because this is just the beginning. I mentioned this in my story. There are the cases of Texas and Florida. Everybody thought these were the cases that were going to hit the Supreme Court first. Those are states run by conservative Republicans, and they have actually passed laws that attack a different aspect of this, where they say, if you want to be protected under Section 230, you can't discriminate against different points of view. So if there's somebody who says the election was stolen and you take it down, you're discriminating against their point of view, and you no longer should have Section 230 protection in our state, and we can sue you for that. And that case, the law like that in Texas was actually upheld by a federal court. And so it's eventually going to end up at the Supreme Court. A similar law in Florida was struck down. So this is going to end up in the Supreme Court, too. Everybody's ganging up on Section 230.
Placing state law against the current status of federal law, which
exactly,
is Section 230.
Exactly.
And that's an interesting one, too. So I'm going to play you a little sound here. Massachusetts mm-hmm. Senator Ed Markey. And
right.
he's talking to Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Of course, now mm-hmm. the company is Meta. Facebook is a piece
right,
of
right,
it.
Right, right, right.
And this is during a Senate Commerce hearing on Section 230.
Exactly.
This is October of 2020.
The issue is not that the companies before us today are taking too many posts down. The issue is that they're leaving too many dangerous posts up. In fact, amplifying harmful content so that it spreads like wildfire and torches our democracy.
And this is also where this second case comes in, right?
Right.
So this is a family also out of California. They lost a loved one in 2017 to
different
an ISIS attack.
A different ISIS yeah. attack, exactly.
This one in Istanbul, and they're saying, hey, you knew there were terrorists on the platform mm-hmm. and you didn't stop them. So
that's right. That's not about the algorithms. They're in their case, they're
that's
just
the
saying,
content.
They're saying you guys should have had some way to keep this stuff from appearing at all. They're making the same argument in the other case, which is called Gonzalez versus Google. But they're adding that extra feature where they say not only did you have it on your platform, you encourage people to look at it.
And that's the algorithm.
And that's the algorithmic part.
So now we come back to the change thing that you talked about mm-hmm. because – so let's look at Florida and Texas versus Ed Markey, right?
Mm-hmm.
Two different sides of the political spectrum.
Right.
Florida and Texas arguing you have no right to take stuff off.
Right.
Ed Markey arguing you are keeping too much stuff on.
Exactly.
And Section 230 saying it doesn't matter, you are immune because it is third-party content.
That's right. Right. You have to look at both halves of Section 230. Section 230 was designed, people forget, the real reason it's the name of the law is the Communications Decency Act. And that is a key to understanding Section 230.
The word decency.
Exactly. Because the original issue they were just trying to fight was how do you keep pornography from running out of control on the internet. And there were attempts to outlaw it, and they were struck down by the Supreme Court. They said you can't just go around willy-nilly outlawing various kinds of things on the internet. So they came up with this compromise, which is Section 230, where the first half of it says an online forum can take down stuff that the owners of that forum consider offensive, distasteful, hateful, et cetera, et cetera.
Because they're private businesses.
Because
so
they're private
not,
businesses,
not
so they
Amendment.
Have a right to take the stuff down. But the second part says, but even so, they are still indemnified if some of that stuff slips through. That was the whole idea. In case something slips through that's offensive or hateful or whatever, they're not responsible because they're not the one who published it. So it was a compromise solution that allowed them to clean up the worst filth on the internet, but at the same time protected them from legal liability. And it, frankly, it worked brilliantly because you got forums like Facebook that were not saturated with filth and at the same time, people, they were able to be confident that they weren't going to get sued anytime any little thing slipped through. And that's why they became these giants that they are today. Now, what happens if they're suddenly legally liable for any bad thing that somebody posts?
So whether if the court finds in favor of either Gonzalez or Taemna, which right. are the 2015 and 2017 ISIS cases.
Exactly.
Then what happens?
That's the problem. It's very difficult to see how their current business model can continue to work, especially with the algorithmic thing, because the algorithms are at the heart of how they make so much money. Why do you think we keep looking at Twitter and Facebook? Because they know what we want, and they just keep giving it to us more and more and more. And that means more and more of our time is spent looking at these services. By the way, the worst of the bunch is the Chinese one, TikTok. They are insanely addictive, but they use the same principle. So it would apply to them too.
And Facebook is losing market share.
Oh, yes. They're losing market share to TikTok. And Facebook is already in trouble for entirely different reasons, especially Apple. People don't know about this. Apple changed the advertising policy. They have this thing where the computer can, where the phone default setting is that you can't track people when you're using an iPhone. And this year, Facebook has predicted itself that it's going to cut revenues by $10 billion. $10 billion just because of that. So it's incredibly, they're at an incredibly fragile place right now. So what happens if the court says, and oh, by the way, if you start using algorithms to recommend things to people that might, you know, encourage violence, you could be sued. They'll have to rethink their entire business model, and I don't see how they can do that without potentially ravaging their advertising.
So what happens on my phone? I'm holding my phone right here. I've got Twitter, so I'm pulling Twitter up right now. If that goes through, what happens on my Twitter feed?
Well, it's hard to know for sure, but presumably you would just go to Twitter and look and see what you would deliberately, it would be like an old school forum where you would look up things yourself.
I'd have to go looking.
You'd have to go looking. It would no longer say, here, you'd like this. You'd like that. And another potential problem that with that came up when I was talking to a guy at the Cato Institute who pointed out one possible dodge would be to stop doing algorithmic sorting for things that were controversial. Mm. So you could do algorithms for people who are interested in stuff about knitting.
So the puppy in a ghost costume here stays, but the public policy stuff maybe goes
away. So suppose you're a Muslim and they say, well, you know, you're discriminating against us because you're afraid we'll find stuff relating to jihad. And of course, the great majority of Muslims aren't interested in that. But if anything like that popped up in my feed, I could you could get sued. So now you're going to say, well, let's not let people look for stuff relating to Islam. Or let's not let people look for stuff relating to abortion activism because there might be connecting to Jane's Revenge or somebody who wants to blow up abortion clinics and so on. It's hard to know how you could do this in a fair way without getting rid of algorithmic searching altogether. And that would really hammer their business model. And we don't know what it would look like. Would the Supreme Court do that? We don't know. But this is really going to be one of the biggest cases relating to internet free speech we've ever seen. And it's going to be very dramatic. We don't know when it's going to go down, but hang on to your hats, folks.
Well, it'll go down. And as I understand it, it'll go down sometime this year. Because if they hear the case this year, then by end of June next year, they're going to tell us what they
decided. That's what I mean. Sometimes by, exactly. It could be into the end, into next year, but they could move faster. We don't know. But this is really important. They're right to take it up, I guess. And then they're going to have to take up those Texas and Florida laws. And then keep in mind, you played the marquee thing.
Yeah.
It's not just the right, it's the left. The left wants Section 230 to be modified in some way to force less information on the internet. They want to censor more stuff. The right is saying, this is censorship. You should let us say anything we want to, up to and including the idea that, you know, Washington is full of pedophiles and all the crazy QAnon stuff. It's a really tough problem.
This is going to be fascinating to watch. This is Tech Talk with Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray, who joins us every other Thursday to usually pretty much blow our minds about something having to do with technology and privacy. Hiawatha, mind blown. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
See, sometimes when people spill their coffee or their internet goes out or they misplace their keys, they think it's chance. And sometimes it is. Sometimes it's us. Nudging people back on plan.
So that's John Slattery, the actor. He's playing Agent Richardson. It's the 2011 film, The Adjustment Bureau. And we're talking about nudges now. In the film, they were powerful, they're sinister, and done in a way that you couldn't do it. So no one's going to, like, secretly make you spill your coffee now so that you miss the bus. But there are nudges in real life, and they can be used for good or bad. And students at Harvard Kennedy School have made a class about nudges one of the most popular. So we're going to learn alongside them today in our latest Brilliant Boston. The course is The Science of Behavior Change. The professor is Todd Rogers, who's here in Studio 2. Todd, welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you.
It's great to be here. What a terrible way to introduce nudges.
We knew you were going to say that. And we were like, so we'll now say, Todd, you introduce nudges now.
Oh, so you set me up. Got it. So nudges or behavioral science is basically just the science of what influences people's choices.
Yeah.
And at the Kennedy School, and this whole approach of nudges is using them for good as opposed to getting people to spill their coffee or whatever that quote was.
To miss the bus.
To miss the bus.
Right.
It's trying to use what we know about human behavior to design the environment and choices so that people make better choices.
And why are you so fascinated by this?
Oh, my God. Well, I don't really want to talk about my childhood, but I'll just say it turns out that there are some easy to implement, low hanging fruit for helping improve all sorts of outcomes, from more equitable hiring to reducing climate change to increasing fertilizer take up in sub-Saharan Africa, like just using light touch interventions. They're not a panacea. They're not a silver bullet, but they're easy to implement and they can pretty dramatically improve outcomes.
So I cue in on something like fertilizer, mm-hmm. right? And that, I think, is a clue to why you would be teaching about nudges, which one might think about more in sort of the marketplace, right? But why you're teaching them in a public policy school like the Harvard Kennedy School.
Yeah, the most – so this whole field starts as it's a combination of behavioral economics, social psychology, cognitive psychology, and lots of other fields. And it's basically just cherry-picking the tools of behavior change that are most potent and most, like, robust. The majority of people who do the kind of work that I and my colleagues do are in business schools. It's very popular in marketing and organizational behavior. But at the Kennedy School, which is why I love being there, like, every student has – a problem they're passionate about trying to solve. And it's an incredible privilege and so much fun watching them apply this to solving important problems that they care about.
So let's dive in there. So I used to be on the faculty at the Boston College School of Social Work. I taught a leadership class there. We talked about nudges and behavioral incentives. I'm going to play a bit of a video I used to use in my class.
Are you going to set me up again?
No,
for manipulation?
No, let's take this on.
Yeah,
let's take this on.
Yeah.
No, because when I would play this for students, the first thing they would say as social work students is, well, wait a minute, is this manipulation or is it helpful? Right? And what I was always taught in this, and I was taught the Cialdini book that you teach in your class, I was taught, well, that's up to the person using them. And is that fair, that whether it's manipulation or it's positive incentive to improve our public health, our community well-being, our climate consumption, those things, isn't that up to the person using it?
So some of these tools can be used for good or bad.
Yeah.
But some can only be used to help people follow through on things they intend to do. So, like, very simply, I intend to go to the gym this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
One intervention would be to make me make a concrete plan, like write down what time am I going to be going, where will I be coming from, and make an implementation plan. That's only useful if it's an intention I have. And it turns out that's pretty powerful in increasing my likelihood of following through.
Okay.
Another one that Cass Sunstein, a colleague of ours at the law school, who wrote the book Nudge with Richard Thaler, they often talk about what the default is. If you do nothing, what happens? So I did a study in Washington, D.C. public schools where we wanted parents to get all this information from the school. The school district was, by default, you were not going to receive this information unless you elected to get it. Only 10% of parents signed up. All the parents are the best performing kids. So we suggested, well, if they do nothing, why don't we make it that they automatically get the information and they can opt out of it if they don't want it? Something has to be the default. So there is no neutral, as Cass and Thaler say. There is no neutral. They have to make the default something. So when we shifted it in D.C. to by default, you're getting this information, 95% of families continued getting the information, and it led to pretty dramatic improvements in academic success. Basically, the school district had just set an arbitrary default, which was if you don't sign up, you're not getting it. But by shifting it, they maintained the freedom to let parents opt out of it, and they also improved student outcomes by, you know, sending this information usefully to parents.
So I'm going to, and by the way, I wasn't setting you up on the second one. This one I consider to be quite neutral, right? But I'm going to play this sound now because we've been talking about these nudges. You've given a few examples. I want to give the listeners a really clear sense of what a basic nudge might look like, all right? So this is from Robert Cialdini. Your book that you were, I keep wanting to say prescribe because we've been doing so much help, but you assign is Influence, Science, and Practice. Here he is. Well, here is a video of his talking about a particular nudge.
So the last time you visit a restaurant, there's a good chance that the waiter or waitress will have given you a gift, probably at about the same time that they bring your bill. A liqueur, perhaps, or perhaps a simple mint. In the study, giving diners a single mint at the end of their meal typically increased tips by around 3%. Interestingly, if the gift is doubled and two mints are provided, tips don't double. They quadruple, a 14% increase in tips.
And that's reciprocity, which we all tend to believe in. You're nodding a lot as you see that video or hear
yeah.
that video.
Yeah, that's first off. I'm joking about it being Ed. Like,
this, no, it's all good. Exactly how it would go down at my kitchen table, and that's what I want. Right?
So that reciprocity is. It's actually one that is sort of personally. I feel really ambivalent about because the basic principle that is describing is that when you give someone an unsolicited gift, they feel this automatic compulsion to reciprocate.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't ask for the gift. And so when you give it to them, you're sort of burdening them with this feeling of obligation to reciprocate. And I do this study, this activity in my class, where the students, many of whom are not from the U.S. and who are not native English speakers, everybody has to go try to raise money for the Greater Boston Food Bank using anything that Cialdini suggests is effective. And almost all of them will be like, okay, we'll bring small candies and we'll give them to people. And then like extraordinarily high rate of if someone accepts the candy, they give you money. And they all write these reflections about how guilty they feel imposing it on them and like how weirdly powerful it is. And I actually, so of all of them, reciprocity is that if listeners are hearing this, like it, you should try it. And then like it's just, it's uncomfortable how automatic the response is. That's why we are so like passionate about avoiding the person in the street who's trying to hand us stuff.
Interesting.
Because like we know if we accept it, we feel obligated to reciprocate.
So what I hear as the key then to using these nudges, these small behavioral nudges, is to work with them to help people, communities, cities, states, towns, countries, accomplish something they've already decided they want.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly. So it's basically we want to use them to help improve well-being and welfare. So
okay.
and preferably in ways that are that people already say that they would they'd rather save money. They'd like to reduce their calories they take in. They'd like to exercise. They'd like to
clean the water in their community.
Yes. They'd like to, you know,
reduce paper plastic bag usage. All those kinds of
yeah,
things.
Yeah.
Okay. So reciprocity is one of the principles that you teach. What are some of the other ones?
I was working with a student yesterday, and it was so fun. So this woman works at a tech company that helps hiring decisions with regards to like criminal records. I want to be opaque a little bit.
Yeah.
A company that helps with criminal hiring companies decide whether to hire other people and offers background checks. And one of the principles she borrowed and they're now using is if a company declines a qualified applicant who has a criminal background that other companies would have hired, right? They'll say that you hire a smaller rate of people with that have certain criminal histories than your peers do, meaning others do it more than you do. And there's tons of evidence that when we say that you do something more than other people or less than other people, you conform to the middle. It's been shown you probably get them in the mail comparing your energy use to your neighbors.
Exactly.
Saying you use more energy than your neighbors. It turns out it reduces energy use the equivalent of increasing the price by 20%. People are incredibly responsive to being told they use more energy than their neighbors or that they're different from the norm. That's one of them.
So when I get that letter right in the mail from my energy company that says, you know, standard use, your neighbor's use, your use.
Yeah.
that will drive my behavior to reduce my energy consumption.
Yes. I did a study in voting. When you say that other people vote at a higher rate than you do, or the majority of people are voting, it makes people meaningfully more likely to vote. But ironically, when we say coming up in the midterm that young people don't vote enough or people of color have lower average voting rates, when we say those kind of messages in the media, we actually become self-fulfilling. It decreases people's likelihood to vote if they think most people like them are not voting.
So reporting on low turnout could have an unintentional consequence of suppressing
self-fulfilling
turnout.
Yes.
And what is the principle? Like, what's the, like, there's this term reciprocity. What's the word?
It's called social norms. We want to be like other people like us. And so if we hear that most people like us are doing something, we're more likely to do it. This is why
yard signs work?
Yard signs, but even better, lots of people in someone's front lawn going through the stuff that seems to be loaded on their front lawn.
Interesting.
You know, a yard sign, fine, it's the information. But when you drive by and there's lots of people there,
mm-hmm.
you're like, shoot, there must be something good here. There's information in that.
So if there's a lot of people at your yard sale, then other people are going to come to your yard sale.
Yes. What you should do if you're doing a yard sale is have friends and family just loiter and pretend they don't know you.
Now, I'm sure that's not a key piece of your, you know, course, but in our remaining time, what is your favorite part of this to teach? Like, whether it's the single class or it's the single principle or it's the single example, what's your favorite part of Nudges? And I should say, I got so into this, I didn't even remind listeners who we're talking to. It's Todd Rogers, who's a professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. This is Brilliant Boston. He teaches about nudges. Your favorite part to teach?
It's hard to know. I think my favorite part about this is these tools are so easy to implement and so powerful that the best part is being at the Harvard Kennedy School. You see these diverse problems
mm-hmm.
that are like seeing them, these same principles that I've been working on for decades and others have been working on apply to whole new problems, solving, you know, important problems for people in the world.
So I want to stay with this. Give me an example of another problem.
Okay. So I told you this one yesterday. There was just a very low stakes, obvious one is there was a woman who runs a charter school.
Okay.
And they want to increase the healthfulness of the food chosen.
And by
the students. And so they what they did was one of the things we do is in the future we think we will do virtuous things. So I'm going to exercise tomorrow for sure, but this afternoon I'm skeptical about.
Dude, have I lived that?
Yeah. So we tend to do the virtuous things in the future. And so what this woman did was she had the students choose what foods, and most students know they're supposed to eat the healthy stuff, but then they choose the Snickers bar. When it's in front of them. So they chose their lunches in the morning that then got sort of pre-prepared because in the COVID world, a lot of the meals are pre-prepared. And so they choose in the morning instead of choosing when it's in front of them. Because when it's in front of you, you're going to choose the Snickers and the frozen yogurt.
Yes,
but
maybe
some fraction of people will choose the salad instead. And so like the idea is structuring the choice so that it happens meaningfully enough before it's going to be implemented that they actually choose the virtuous thing and they lock themselves in.
Fascinating. All right. So that's Todd Rogers. He is a professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. In our latest Brilliant Boston, he teaches a course on nudges and how they can be applied to public policy solutions. This was a blast. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We turn back now to the world of comics, which we've been exploring with our intrepid guide, Joel Christian Gill, who's the inaugural chair of BU's MFA program in visual narrative. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we have another guest today. You brought with you Robin Smith, the illustrator of a beautiful comic, Wash Day Diaries. Robin, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you.
So, Joel, as we were ramping up to have you on the show more often, you had said right off the bat, you wanted to talk to Robin. You wanted to do Wash Day Diaries. It was important to you. So tell us why. I'm holding Wash Day Diaries right here. Why did you want to do this book?
So you know how stories, sometimes stories are written for other people. And when those stories are written for other people, when you're not a snowflake, you can just be okay with that being somebody else's story. And, you know, I can understand that. Like, I tell people, like, watching Beyoncé's Lemonade was not something that I know was directed at someone else other than me. And when you pick up Wash Day, initially that's what you think. It's about four black women and the story of their weekend, and they're just like a, you know, like a slice of life of their lives that you don't think will necessarily connect to you if you're not a black woman or you're not a person of color. And that book doesn't do that. It is something that everybody could read automatically. I was so excited I sent Robin an email like, this book is fire. As soon as I got it, I made everybody in my family read it. It was just real, like, it's well drawn. It's interesting, the story. I couldn't put it down. It was just amazing.
So, Robin, you were the illustrator on it. It was written by Jamila Rouser. Do you think it's fire?
I definitely think it's fire. Also, thanks, Joel. That was so nice of you to say. I mean, I got your email and was like, wow, that's so sweet.
I mean, it's such an amazing book. And the way in which you tell that story and the way which y'all tell that story is so engaging. And it immediately, you know, like you immediately want to know what's going on each time. And then like the choices that you made, and we'll talk more about that, but the choices you made and how like the colors match the day was, I think, brilliant. Most people don't think about like how color helps tell the story. And I thought that was just an amazing way. I was just like, the color is incredible, the way these people are drawn. And like, can I just gush about how Black people draw Black people?
Yes.
Right? Because like, some people don't draw Black people in a very specific, like a very sophisticated way. They think we're all just brown, right? And we're not.
Yeah.
And I think that you capture all of those things in the story, and I just love everything about it.
So, Robin, let me allow you to be more flattered and honored, and then I'm going to delve into some of the details in the books, but pick it up there.
I mean, I feel like everything I've ever made is just like, they're just comics about Black people. I have to agree with Joel. I just feel like Black people drawing Black people is something that is really important in comics. Especially because I just feel like we all see each other all every day, you know, like, we know like the way that we look and how our family members look, how our friends look. I just feel like I enjoy so much just like putting the features of my friends and family all over like my comics. And I have a real problem when someone just draws a white character and then just like, like Phil Brown, and then suddenly they're a Black person.
Phil Brown, I see that.
So interesting. We actually did a segment, Robin, a few years ago here on the art of John Singer Sargent, and the fact that, in fact, the model for his art, all these white angels and cherubs and gods, et cetera, in his work, the model was a Black man. What he did in that case was he would sketch this Black man and then make him white. And you're talking about the opposite here, finding a way not to just draw a generic white character and make them Black, but draw a whole complete. And these are four characters, Kim Cookie, Nisha Devine. They are four complete women with really deep variations in their size, their shape, their skin color, freckles, the length of their hair, the way they style their hair, the way they treat their hair as they choose. And this care of their Black hair is one of the themes that runs through this book. But what it's really about is friendship. And as a white woman, right, as I started into the book, the way I engaged with it was, oh, I want friends like this.
Exactly. That's the thing, right? You read it and it's like, even though I'm not a woman, I'm like, I want my friends to be these people. Do you know what I mean? And I think that that's a thing. Stories have to connect. And I've said this before, and I will continue to say it until I'm blue in the face, if that's a possible thing. But the stories have to connect to people, and this story connects. And it connects on multiple levels. And I think, you know, it connects with me for art and, like, the sophistication of how Black people are drawn, because that's something I feel strongly about. But it also tells a story that I think everybody can get into. And I think that that story, you know— So let me ask you this question, Robin, because I think this is probably better. Tell us why you chose to draw each character in a different color.
Well, it was kind of like a decision between Jamila and I. We already started with Kim and Cookie for our like mini comic that we did so long ago. And I mean, it's just common sense to make two characters look very, very different. And I think, I feel like diverse, like having a diverse cast, but they're Black women is possible, you know, like there's so many different like iterations of what a Black woman looks like. So that wasn't like very hard to create like two best friends look completely different. Like Kim, she's African American, and then Cookie is like Dominican and Puerto Rican, but obviously Afro-Latino. And then we decided, like, when we got the call from Chronicle to expand the story, we were like, well, easy. That's two more Black women. Who, Daveen is Jamaican, which I, like, I'm Jamaican. I know so many Jamaican people. And then there's Nisha, who I based on my friend Kamisha, who was really passionate about, like, hair care and had her thesis about, like, hair, like, Black women's hair. So I was just like, oh, this is a very easy thing to do. Making them all look very different, having them all be different skin colors was also just so every Black woman who's reading it had a chance to, like, see, like, their hair care process and, like, their skin tone and, like, maybe the different sort of, like, body shape that they have, you know, be, like, centered in the story. Because, I enjoy reading stories that have, like, at least one Black character, obviously, that I can be like, oh, this is relatable. But then having, like, a plethora of, like, features featured in a book, like, I can pick and choose and be like, oh yeah, part of that is me, part of that
you
is
you find
me.
Yourself and, in all of them.
Yeah,
right. So that's, like, more fun.
So we're speaking with Robin Smith, who is the illustrator of Wash Day Diaries, which is the longer graphic novel version of what was originally a shorter comic called Wash Day. And our regular guide to the world of comics, Joel Christian Gill, who's the chair of Boston University's MFA in visual narrative. Robin, I want to come back to this question of Black hair. Because there is in America a political dimension to the question of Black hair, and it's come home to roost explicitly here in the Commonwealth this year, because we became the 18th state to pass the Crown Act, which bans discrimination based on hairstyle at school and at work. The House has passed that at the federal level. It hasn't come into law at the federal level, but I'm going to play a little sound from Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley on the House floor in 2020 talking about hair discrimination.
From personnel handbooks to school dress code policies, afros, locks, and twists have been codified as proxies for our Black skin and manifestations of anti-Black racism. From as early as grade school, Black girls are pushed out of school for wearing their hair naturally, and as we grow up, we are taught to straighten our hair if we want to get a job or simply to live our lives in peace.
So I want to point out, one, that, of course, the Congresswoman went through her own public journey, where first, as she entered elected office in the Boston City Council as the first Black woman, her braids were often a source of pushback. And then she experienced alopecia and chose to publicly show that she had alopecia and now proudly doesn't wear a wig and is bald and has embraced that. So I can't not mention that piece of the Congresswoman. But I'm also, each woman has her story of Black hair in this book. And one of the women actually expresses concern. She doesn't go to work because she couldn't get her hair done. And she got discriminated against at work when she went to with natural hair once before. So talk about that.
So, Daveen's story, I feel like it's to point that out. Like that, the fact that like there needs to be like the Crown Act just so that Black women can exist with something that naturally grows out of their head, like in professional spaces, is like not crazy, because I also grew up with it. Cause I mean, growing up in Jamaica, which is like almost like it's 92% of like African descent, there was still like this, so many rules around how we could wear our hair to school and what was considered neat and like professional, sophisticated, and what wasn't. And that was like wearing your natural hair out. You know, it'd be like, you can't wear that big bush to school or whatever. Just so many aspects that sort of like have beaten down Black women's like idea of themselves that like are natural to them, I think, is why we decided to focus on that, at least in one story, because again, we're just trying to show the many different stories that Black women have and like when it comes to their hair specifically, but also like as they interact with each other as friends, because that obviously is also an important part of the book. But it was also really important for us to show like the joy around it. So having a friend come help, and even though it does, the story itself, Bright Side, ends on a sort of like ambivalent note of, maybe that's not the right word, but like a note where, you know, there were sort of different ideas around mental health and the connection between like hair, especially Cookie being like a lighter skinned woman who has like a a looser curl pattern. I think all of those play into like a tension that can happen between Black women as well. So,
I think, you know, Robin, I think that thing you said about it not, it's not crazy. I think it is crazy. The fact that you have to have a law for Black women to be able to wear their hair.
And the way it naturally grows.
The way it naturally grows. I mean, I grew up, you know, you know I'm bald, but I grew up with dreadlocks, right? And mm-hmm. and that was definitely a thing that people would always have something, they would assume something about me because of the way my hair was. And it's a thing that I wish I could express to people mm-hmm. what it's like to see yourself represented and it to be in a professional manner and the way who you are, right? Naturally who you are being represented in media and seeing Black women with natural hair and the whole idea of natural hair and how that was definitely connected to a political movement about Black people not accepting European standards of beauty and mm-hmm. European standards of professionalism. You know, as a multicultural society, why do we always have a specific type of attire that we decide is professional versus that? Right. Like, this is one of the reasons why I refuse to wear businessman shoes. So, because I feel like I don't need to wear your shoes and your coat in order to be professional. Just talk to me. I can give you knowledge without actually having my nails not painted. You know what I
mean? So I want to pick back up on that. And again, we're speaking, you've just heard Joel Christian Gill, who's the chair of Boston University's MFA in Visual Narrative. And we're speaking with Robin Smith, who is the illustrator of Wash Day Diaries, your colleague on that, Jamila Rouser, who was the author. Four chapters of each woman's experience, and then a fifth chapter where they all go out together at the end. And we've been talking about black hair, and I could go into, there's sort of a hair care ritual in each chapter that tells you a lot about their friendship and a lot about each of them. But I got to tell you where I really want to go, which is in the last chapter, when they become warriors for their friend, protecting her at a bar from a guy who's been essentially stalking her. And what I loved about it, and it was a place that I felt like everyone can connect, Robin, was not only that they did it, but they didn't even tell her. They just took care of it for her because she was performing and she needed to have her head in the game. That's right. Friendship. And did that come from a personal story of yours? How on earth did you think that up is the way to bring all of this together at the end?
I feel like Jamila Moore has personally experienced things like that. And like being the writer, she really is good at incorporating her own experiences. And then knowing that the truth is a lot of women have experienced something like that, and having like your ride or die friend group, and the name of the story is Ride or Die, who will always have your back and like are watching out, are like, I feel like what I really love about that story too, is it just shows that they're paying attention. And I think that's so important in friendships. And I think that's what Jamila is really good at writing about in like these women's relationships, is that they just pay a lot of attention to each other. They saw him, like Nisha had spotted him immediately and was like in action. And they all, it's almost as if they trained for this moment.
Yes.
But the truth is that they just like are aware. And I mean, I've had that experience with my friends, not necessarily with like a stalker, but just going out to parties and like any man that was just sort of getting too close, immediately I would be just dragged across the room by one of my friends and I'd have another friend swoop in and be like, don't touch her.
Yeah, you don't even need a signal. You don't have to like give them a signal or anything. They just like they can read that information and they're just like, oh, I got to go get her.
So, right. So this is where I want to close then, Joel. We've got about a minute left. Every time we talk comics, you remind us that there is something about the visual depiction that allows us to connect with empathy to another person's experience. And I have to assume that you thought there was particular art, literally and figuratively, in how Robin did that in this book.
Yeah, this her art. This story, the way Robin draws these women, you know, I get really angry when I watch TV most of the time because all of the people are beautiful and they're so a specific type of beautiful. Robin doesn't do that. These are all real people. They felt like people that I knew, even though I don't know anybody like that, right? They felt like they were people who were who were very real. And I think that that's the beauty of how visual language and comics connect to people. It's the ability to make these pink and yellows and greens and blues on black women look like real and make me think that these are real people. I think that's the beauty of how comics work.
All right, so that was this week's installation. You just heard Joel Christian Gill, who's the chair of Boston University's MFA in Visual Narrative. Joel brought with him today Robin Smith, who is the illustrator of Wash Day Diaries, your partner on that, Jamila Rouser, the author of it. And we'll do this again in a couple of weeks. But in the meantime, Joel, Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So much fun.
We decided last minute we wanted to do this because we want to do a loving tribute to Dennis Eckersley. Eck himself, one of the great Red Sox pitchers, first chimed in as part of the Red Sox broadcast team in 2002. And over the last 20 years, he's had this magnetic charisma, sometimes brutal honesty, and most of all, love and passion for the game that have helped a whole generation of baseball fans fall in love. You have to understand, probably the best thing about Eck, besides his love of the game, was the fact that he basically spoke his own language. And if you were a fan who spent any time watching games on Essen in the recent years, you know what I mean. So for me, the word, it's all about the cheese. So we wanted to pay tribute to some of those Eckisms today. And back in August 2018, WBUR's Chris Sitterick hosted Radio Boston and used his Week in Review hubbub to highlight some of the more colorful Eckisms.
All right. Well, mine is a lot less important than any of the other stuff we've talked about. But I had to say, Chad Finn did an explainer for Dennis Eckersley slang. It's linked on the Globe website. If you watch the Red Sox game, Dennis Eckersley in the booth has been one of the best parts of that broadcast. Such phrases as cheese, educated cheese, salad, educated salad, hair, which is actually referring to a fastball and its movement, moss, which is actually referring to the hair on your head, branch work and falling out of your tree, iron lamb, parachutes, lots of great stuff. Dennis Eckersley, a great addition to the Red Sox broadcast, so that's my hot dog.
All right. So that was Chris Sitterick again hosting Radio Boston's Week in Review, August 2018, with Michael Curry and Ed Lyons. That's who you're hearing chuckle in the background. And he was talking about Red Sox great Dennis Eckersley. Dennis Eckersley signed off for the final time as a broadcaster for the Boston Red Sox last night, capping off a 50-year career in baseball. And not for nothing, at a Red Sox win, which is a good deal anymore. He signed off as a player and then as a broadcaster.
I tell you, this is, I was never more touched before in my life, you know, and it's something I will never forget.
Yeah, we agree. We are sure going to remember you, Eck. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.